Taken on toward millions that they never toil to earn, but without our brain and muscle.
Well, here we are with our brain and muscle. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I think we're joined by Sid Ryan. Are you there, Sid?
Song tune you are playing there.
I'm afraid we played you. I really feel bad about this, but I'm really glad you're still there and available. And I want to tell everybody, you're going to be at the Lula Lounge at 1585 Dundas West. And that's on April the 23rd. That's the most important thing, 7 p.m. It's a book launch, and you're going to be introduced. The host is Anthony Shelton, really highly respected and appreciated man in the labor movement. You're going to be in conversation with Linda McQuaig. And there's going to be a performance by the Special Interest Group. We all look forward to that. Your book, A Grander Vision, My Life in the Labor Movement. Last week on the show, we said that actually you were the life of the labor movement. Your life in the labor movement, it's like telling all the most important stories of this of your generation. I like the fact that through the book you continually are quoting people who, and particularly one woman who said to you, "Don't forget your roots." And I think you have seen to it that you didn't. Who is she, and what is the? How important is this? The reference to your own origins.
Well, first off, thank you for that kind introduction, and for. Letting the viewers know about the book launch next Tuesday, the 23rd. That was Helen O'Regan. She was a staff rep in QPC, has since unfortunately passed on. But she was a staff representative who did a lot of organizing within QP over the years. And she was from, you know, Never Forget Your Roots, and particularly during the time when we were having some difficulties with the Bob Rae government over the social contract. Mm-hmm. She was a very strong supporter of making sure that we stood by our trade union principles and not sell out just because we were supportive of the NDP. But one thing about it is the labor movement will always be there. And, you know, governments do come and go, and you can't sell your principles just because of looking for some short-term gains.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to Sid Ryan, and again, I want to just keep saying, there's going to be a big book launch, and it's going to be at 1585 Dundas West, Lula Lounge, on April the 23rd, 7 p.m. You know, that point, it strikes me as, really, isn't that the story, not only of your personal struggles and as a union man, but as the history of the labor movement is continually trying to bring people back to what is this all about? From the first people who organized unions, they weren't people with short-term visions or what we call business unionism. They were looking at the whole society they were living in.
Precisely, and you know, one of the one of my idols, at least in life, was Big Jim Larkin, who was a trade union leader in Ireland, in Dublin, at the turn of the last century, when he took. 60,000 laborers out on strike against the an array of private sector businesses that lined up against the union and basically starved 60,000 low-paying folks who were living in tenement housing in the centre of Dublin at the time. And they beat them into submission by forming an alliance that essentially said, if you belonged to a union or were signing Jim Larkin's union cards, you'd be either fired on the spot or you would not be hired. So they kept these workers out on strike for about 6 months, and eventually the strike collapsed because people were just literally starving. Mm-hmm. So Jim Larkin's vision, of course, was that of socialism and that of sharing the wealth and trying to raise people out of poverty. And that stuck with me throughout my life because, you know, I lived in relative poverty growing up in Ireland. And though, you know, I don't want to leave anybody with the impression I had an amazing childhood. and we made do with what we had. But but I also understood what it was like living in poverty, and consequently, when I became a union leader in Canada, one of the goals, of course, was to always make certain that, as Helena Reagan said, never forget your roots, and always be pushing to make life better for others, particularly those that that blessed you with the opportunity to represent them in the workplace.
The only thing you had going for you was the Ontario Health and Safety, the law governing whether you could be made to do that job.
So what happened was in the late 1970s, the government passed a new piece of legislation after Labour had been lobbying for this for about 10 or 15 years. And it gave workers the right to refuse unsafe work if you felt that your life was in danger. And I worked in the Pickering nuclear power plant. And by the way, I'm opposed to nuclear power, but it's where I earned my living at the time. But the nuclear power plants are these massive concrete structures, these domes. You probably see photographs of them. And the Canadian system is the domes are connected to what's called a vacuum building through a massive concrete structure, which is called ducting. It's about 12 feet high by about 12 foot wide, 2-inch concrete. So theoretically, what happens if there's a nuclear accident? The radioactivity gets sucked out of the nuclear buildings into the vacuum duct, and then it is pulled down into the vacuum building. Now, when that happens, there are winds in this tunnel of something like 1,200 miles an hour. So I asked the question. I said, "Well, what happens if I'm in here and there's a pressure differential, and somehow these big, huge monster valves open to suck all of the radioactivity out of the vacuum duct? What happens to me?" And like, "Oh yeah, you'll be sucked in through those valves." And I said, "Like the hell I will." So I wanted to know what kind of protections we had, and turns out not very much. And so I just said, "Look, I'm just refusing underneath this Occupational Health and Safety Act." And of course, the company put tremendous pressure on me. This piece of legislation had never been tested in the province before.
Oh my God.
And I was like the guinea pig for it. And it certainly had never been tested in the nuclear industry. So many, many meetings ensued where they tried to put pressure on me to go into the building, and I refused to go in. So, of course, they had their nuclear reactors had to be put down in a safe mode at this stage and reduced power. Mm-hmm. So anyway, at the end of the day, the Ministry of Labour actually agreed with my position that I didn't have sufficient training, nor did the company have sufficient safety protections for workers going in and out of these vacuum buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So so it worked out well. At the end of the day, we first off, I was able to prove to workers in the plant that you can use the Occupational Health and Safety Act to protect yourself and your fellow workers, and we don't have to accept their, you know, unsafe conditions. So anyway, that was quite an episode during that period. And you know, I was in my late 20s at the time, and yeah, you're right, it was a big risk. I could have been fired. And that was the pressure that was applied to me, that, you know, I could lose my job. Because, you know, there is no doubt in my mind, every accident is preventable. And there's been too many employers in this country have gotten away with killing workers on the job and nothing happens to them. Maybe a slap on the wrist through a fine. And I developed this campaign when I was at the OFL. I called it like "Kill a Worker, Go to Jail." And I said, it's the only way we're going to stop the carnage in our workplaces is if the CEO of these companies, private sector companies, or even public sector companies, are marched out of those buildings, out of the ivory towers, in handcuffs, and they go to jail for having killed a worker through their negligence, having killed a worker on the job. So, it gave me certainly the drive to be able to put that campaign in place.
Yeah, that... by the way, I know many people threw their hats in the air when you did that on the "Kill a Worker, Go to Jail." That was one of the most popular causes that, and a result of your initiation. Again, while we're talking about the larger vision, and when we're on that, you think it's very important that we have real flesh and blood links to struggles elsewhere. And we have some issues such as, I'll go to one that you were, first of all, involved with because you participated in a meeting. You went to Argentina where there were a lot of leaders, including a man, I don't think he'd been elected yet, the man who's president of Bolivia today. You also met Argentine labor leaders and folks like that. This is a learning link, isn't it? You get involved with these other movements, you share ideas, but also you have a responsibility to help each other.
I cannot stress enough the importance of internationalism, where workers go to meet with workers in other countries. One of the things that we did with Argentina and at the time six other Latin American countries was we invited workers from the healthcare systems in those countries. El Salvador had just gone through an attempted privatization of the healthcare system, and they managed to put people on the streets that actually stopped the privatization of the El Salvadoran healthcare system. So we said, you know what, we can learn from these folks, so we should invite them up to Canada. So we had six nations with representatives of workers came to Niagara Falls, and we called that that was the first healthcare workers conference of the Americas. And then we built upon that and went back then. We were invited into Argentina, and we grew into 12 countries attended the second meeting, international meeting. And eventually we had 19 countries representatives participating in this healthcare workers, face-to-face meetings. Mm-hmm. So it was really, really important. And then out of that, we made contacts in Latin America that helped us when we get into the big fights around the free trade of the Americas. The good instinct, and from reading, what was going on in Europe, and the Europeans had come out, like they had teamed up with farmers and seniors and healthcare workers. And so I could see that there was a movement was building in Europe, and that through social media, they were going to start arriving in the United States down in Seattle. So at the last minute, I basically jumped on the plane and went down there, and my gut instinct was correct. The whole thing blew up, and it put the whole question of the World Trade Organization on the map, and civil society opposition to these deals that were being negotiated behind closed doors.
You almost became a Canadian reporter. They were calling you, and you told them where the fights were.
Well, what happened is when I got down there, of course, none of the media in Canada were covering this story. And so when it blew up and there was all sorts of protests on the streets, and the participants from the different nations couldn't get into their meetings because particularly the young folks outside had blockaded the entrances to the convention center. So then the police began to attack the protesters. And you're firing tear gas at them and so on. So that's when the CBC and CTV and Global News got involved, and they're looking to see who was down there. And somebody put out a press release from my office to say I was there, and that became then I was giving reports on an hourly basis back to Canada.
Your nickname ought to be Lightning Rod. Your book, by the way, now listen, you're an important witness. You keep showing up at places we need to know about, and it's got to get this book. It's a whale of a book. But you actually saw some police provocateurs. I want people to understand, labor movement has got to look out. Anybody organizes demonstrations better look out. You spotted some guys that the police were delivering. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, I was walking. It was, again, when we were down in Seattle, and at one stage I had to run down a side street to get away from the tear gas because it was choking me, right? So as I was making my way back to the main square after the tear gas had dissipated, this big truck pulled up, and like a big van. And the doors opened, and out the back jumped. That was a policeman. Like out the door, back jumped five, six, seven guys, dressed in bandanas and had sticks in their hands. And I was like, "What the hell? These are cops. What's going on here?" And they were banging these.
Your Irish instincts kicking.
Yeah, and they were essentially urging people to join in with them as they were making their way up to the main intersection where the young kids were holding their demonstrations. So clearly, they were provocateurs trying to look for a reason, for an excuse to arrest some young kids. And by the way, the same thing happened in Quebec City. There was a union of protesters to justify, in some respects, the massive expenditures that the government had poured into Quebec City.
And to criminalize people who are opposing.
Exactly. And this is what it was all about, to make it look really bad that the government was doing the good thing by protecting public property and so on. But that's, I mean, this is part and parcel of protests in North America, and I dare say even in Europe. But certainly I witnessed it both in Quebec City, and I witnessed it down in Seattle. So clearly it goes on.
I'm really glad you told that story again. That's why the book is so valuable. Now, another aspect of that is you found something else there that you really didn't agree with, which is the tendency of rather conservative elements within labor to sort of try to take their people away from these things. And in Seattle, you found they were at a stadium somewhere else listening to long speeches.
Well, you know, see, this is it. Like, the labor movement has really yet to embrace, you know, social unionism and working with our coalition partners. So when I got to Seattle, you know, I could see all these students on the streets, and civil society was out there, there's no question about it. But I'm looking around for ages and say, where's the labor movement? And after asking several people, they said, oh, there's a football stadium. It's about 10 minutes out of town. That's where the labor movement is. So true enough, I made my way over to that stadium. And there had to be 25, 30,000 people in the stadium listening to speeches. I thought, this is crazy. What are we all doing here? They said, do you know what's going on in the streets in downtown Seattle? So I bumped into Maude Barlow, and as soon as Maude heard, you know, what was going on, she says, well, what the hell are we all sitting here for? So then she started getting a whole bunch of Canadian folks to get out of the stadium and let's get down to where all the action was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by the way, the same thing happened when we got into Quebec City. The labor movement had agreed that they would walk away from the barricades and the walls that was erected by the police and by the government. And instead of going to walk the 60,000 protesters that we had out that day, they were marching them off to an empty parking lot.
Yeah.
And I decided that's not
whenever you
Ontario.
Hear the word parking lot, think, no, that must be a mistake. Somebody's made a mistake.
Yes, no, they didn't. And people were royally ticked off when they discovered that they were actually walking to an empty parking lot and not going down to where the action was, down at the barricades, which had, you know, was separating the international delegations from what I call the great unwashed outside, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that was, and that caused a bit of a rift because, you know, I was meant to be going along with what the leadership had decided. And I says, look, nobody decides for our organization, QP Ontario, that we're going to go to Quebec City and somehow march out to an empty parking lot. Yeah. That's not on.
Yeah. No, what you call for is the kind of thing happened with the, what did they call that, the red patch, where the students and labor got to start walking the streets of...
You know, with childcare issues and seniors issues and access to the healthcare system and access to social programs, you know, so it became a massive movement, not just of the of the students. And that's, you know, one of the reasons I wish the student movement in Ontario would really take a leaf out of the book of the student movement over in Quebec.
Yeah.
And I'm not buying that somehow they're, you know, they're different over in Quebec than what we are over here. It's all about political will.
Well, Ireland is different
to get out onto the streets and organize your people.
Yeah. Venezuela is different. Cuba is different. Sure, we can all learn. This is Sid Ryan. He's going to be at the Lula Lounge, April 23rd, 7 p.m. And Linda McQuaig is going to be there in conversation with Sid. And there's going to be a performance by a group called the Special Interest Group. I like that. 1585 Dundas West. Sid, lastly here, you finished the book, really powerful finish, in my opinion. It had to do with your closing speech at the OFL. And I think you quoted Seamus Heaney, if I got the name right.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Good for you, using poets. Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
They have a lot of good ideas. You have a vision, and you hope labor will pick it up in 2020. It has to do with gender and age class and such. What is it you're looking for in 2020? You want the labor movement to do?
Basically, I'm trying to get the labor movement to focus in on who I believe are the next generation of union leaders and who are the folks that we should be out there trying to organize. And these are the precarious workers. These are the workers that the Workers' Action Center, you know, the $15 an hour campaign. These folks went out and organized young workers, young immigrants in many cases. And that's what we need to be doing. But in order for us to be able to organize those workers, we have to start having our organizations reflect that community that we're trying to organize. So electing, you know, older white guys like me, they'd have been great for back in the 50s, 60s and 70s, 80s. But now we've got to start looking at creating space for young workers, workers of color, indigenous workers, the Aboriginal community, women. These are the workers that we need to be taking a look at. So it was like a call to arms in some respects to say to the labor movement, look, take a look around this. This city in the city of Toronto has got 50-51% of the population are people of color. And as I take a look at what's taking place around us in this hall, I bet you out of the 1,000 delegates at the convention, if we had 30 or 40 people of color, that was about it.
Yeah.
And the challenge was, you know, by 2025 or 2030, half this hall should at least be people of color. And we should start moving these folks into the leadership ranks of the labor movement. So it's one of those kind of speeches to say, leave them with a message to say we're not doing nearly well enough when it comes to representing the workers that we hope to bring into the ranks of the labor movement.
Good. I think they need to get the book and they should start at the back and read that speech first. It's Sid Ryan. It's a wonderful book, a grander vision. Thanks an awful lot, Sid.
Okay, fellas, appreciate you taking the time. Okay. But don't forget, April the 23rd, next Tuesday, the Lula Lounge.
We'll all be there, and I'm gonna come get you to sign the book. Thank you.
Absolutely, love to. Thanks very much, fellas. Okay.
Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT. Get with the membership drive. Go to CIUT.fm and start now. Remember the Taylor Report when you do that. And Mick, thank you. And Phil, we'll see you next week.
Sadene Indigenous Wave CIUT Satdegunni Wasajo to Yujisto Korewisk FM.